says the inflaton is contributing to the energy momentum tensor at the universe. These fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor from point to point end up setting up fluctuations in the metric from point to point. And fluctuations in the metric, in turn, influence matter. And these metric fluctuations end up, producing density fluctuations. And the density fluctuations correspond to fluctuations in the photons, in the baryons, and in the dark matter. And photons and baryons and dark matter all behave differently in terms of their subsequent evolution. So dark matter is very simple. Dark matter you can think of as a fluid of non-relativistic particles that is basically not interacting at all except under gravity. Whereas photons and baryons do interact a lot with each other. The photons are relativistic. The baryons are non-relativistic, but they're tightly coupled. And one of the upshots of that is that if you look at the growth of these fluctuations, the dark matter fluctuations can start to grow in an efficient way as soon as matter becomes a dominant source of energy density in the universe. And this happens, at a redshift of about 3200. On the other hand, the photons and the baryons remain coupled until recombination. So recombination corresponds to the point where atomic nuclei and electrons, so mostly protons and free electrons, bind to form neutral atoms. And at that point, the universe becomes essentially electrically neutral, and photons decouple from the baryons and essentially free stream. And this happens at a redshift of about 1100. So the story of fluctuations is that the fluctuations in dark matter start to evolve in a strong way earlier than the fluctuations in baryons, which only start to evolve in a strong way after they decouple from the photon fluid at later time recombination. But in any case, these fluctuations, primarily in dark matter, evolve following the usual Einstein equations for general relativity. But the source, the evolution is sourced by the metric fluctuations and the density fluctuations, and you can track their subsequent evolution. And the point is that early on, these fluctuations can grow in amplitude. And later on, when the fluctuations get big enough, they become unstable against self-gravitating. They'll collapse on themselves. And this forms a structure we see, this forms the structure that ends up becoming galaxies and so on. So the story of dark matter collapse is eventually the dark matter fluctuations collapse. And the collapse is related to something called a gene's instability. And you'll go over the gene's instability with Tibra in the tutorial later today. And this collapse corresponds to the mass density in dark matter starting to self-gravitate. And when this happens, you start to form compact objects. And these relatively compact objects form potential wells that then pull the baryons in. So the story is that the dark matter fluid evolves in a certain way. It eventually becomes unstable. It collapses on itself. And this pulls the baryons in. And the baryons end up going off to form things like stars and galaxies and so on that are visible. But the point is, under this story, the structure in terms of visible stuff tracks in a reasonable way the density of dark matter. So when you look out and you see very, very large, when you see fluctuations in terms of the density in terms of visible stuff, that stuff is more or less tracking the density of the dark matter. So this is actually a nice feature, because by looking at these density fluctuations, you can get an idea of how dark matter evolved in the early universe. And you end up seeing that you really need dark matter to explain the structure of fluctuations that you get. OK, so I'm going to go over structure on the galactic scale, as well as the largest scales we can see. So I'll start off with the very large scales. So I'll start off with very so-called large scale structure. OK, so one example of large scale structure that you're already very familiar with is the cosmic microwave background. And here in the cosmic microwave background, you see fluctuations in the temperature relative to the total temperature of roughly 1 part in 10^-5 or so. We can, and then there's a whole machinery for characterizing the structure of these fluctuations, the so-called the CLs that you see in terms of this nice bump and wiggle plot. And we can do something very similar for fluctuations in the matter density. So fluctuations in terms of how much visible stuff you see here and there, which, as I just argued, tracks the density of dark matter. So the way we do that is, there's all kinds of notation here just to warn you, but I can write down a local density fluctuation as the local number density minus the mean number density normalized to the mean number density. And what I mean by the mean is I just average over everywhere in space. I average over the number density of stuff everywhere. Now, it's going to be useful to Fourier transform this. So I can also define the Fourier transformed version of this, which is just a matter of expanding this in plane waves. And I'm doing a slight abuse of notation in that I'm using the same variable delta to describe the Fourier transform as I am for this. So sometimes people put tildes on this. I may or may not remember to put on tildes. OK, so the k here, the k here is just called the wave number. And you'll recall from just basic quantum mechanics that in terms of the Fourier transform, stuff going on at small k is going to correspond to very large distances, and vice versa. Large k will correspond to small distances. OK, so given this definition, this is the thing one usually looks at, because it turns out that this is much easier to describe in terms of its evolution. And by definition, if I average over stuff, I just get zero for the single thing. But what I'm really interested in is fluctuations. So I can look at the two-point function. And again, the average is over all the space. I average over the density of fluctuations everywhere, and then Fourier transform it. And this should be a second different momentum. This quantity, at least early on, is going to be proportional, first of all, to a three-dimensional delta function. So how shall I write this? So this three-dimensional delta function comes from the fact that we expect that at least reasonably early on, the different k evolve independently. And this is equivalent to the statement that I can write linear equations that only depend on a single k to describe their evolution. Now this form of a two-point function might remind you of what you saw in quantum field theory in terms of the two-point the two-point function for a free field. Now, the average I'm doing here is different from the average you're doing there. In the quantum field theory, you're looking at an expectation value between two vacuum states. Here, I'm doing an average over the structure of all of space-time. But there, you got a three-dimensional delta function. And the reason you get a three-dimensional delta function here is exactly the same, that the different k modes evolve independently. Now, this piece, this p of k, is called the matter power spectrum. And this thing is measurable. This thing is measurable in galaxy surveys. And again, just to warn you on notation, sometimes people will, so if I look at dimensions, this quantity is dimensionless. This has dimension of 1 over momentum cubed. So sometimes people will define a related power spectrum quantity, delta squared. It's usually written as k cubed or 2 pi squared. There's no physics here except just a different notation. All right. So what we can do is look at a lambda CDN universe with inflation, and given a basic inflation model and the lambda CDM contents of the universe, you get a prediction for the fluctuations in the primordial fluctuations in the inflaton field, and given lambda CDM, you get you can track the subsequent evolution of these fluctuations in terms of fluctuations in the in terms of the density of dark matter after that. And you can compare that with observation. So it's a bit of a mess. So I don't want to go through how you actually do that tracking. It's covered in a very nice way in Donaldson's cosmology textbook. I actually want to focus on the particle physics aspects of dark matter, but I felt that it's important for you guys to just get an idea of this. But the upshot of this is that when you track the evolution, what you find for P of K versus K, well, first of all, the lambda CDM predictions agree with observations. And the result, and let me try to draw this relatively nicely, looks something like this. So the matter power spectrum that you see, and also that you predict from lambda CDM plus inflation, has this general form. So in this region, at small k corresponds to very, very large distances. This thing is roughly linear in k. And obviously, there's a turnover. And here it falls off. And the reason for the turnover is that these density fluctuations evolve very differently during matter domination versus radiation domination. So that's the first point. The second point is that for a given k, the evolution of a fluctuation in a given k mode evolves differently depending on whether it's larger or smaller than the Hubble radius at a given time. So there are two important points. There's the relationship of k versus the inverse Hubble radius. And I guess I should say AK. And the second point is whether the universe is matter dominated or radiation dominated. Oops. Should be radiation. So the reason for this, so this turnover corresponds to where modes that that enter the horizon when matter radiation equality happens. So in other words, this peak corresponds to K modes that enter the horizon, that become of the same size as the Hubble radius, right when matter and radiation become equal in density. On this side, I have very large fluctuations, and these very large fluctuations only enter the horizon after matter becomes a dominant source of energy density in the universe. So it turns out that these fluctuations basically track the primordial fluctuations in a careful way. Over here, you have a fall off. And the fall off here, and this is for relatively small modes, the fall off for these small modes comes about because these modes enter the horizon while radiation is still dominant. And these modes get washed out to some extent by the radiation. So on this side, you have a fall off from this radiation washout. You have a peak here, and on this side, you just get an increase with K, which is what you would expect from the primordial spectrum before being reprocessed. And the important point is the location of this peak and the relative shapes are a prediction for lambda CDM plus inflation. And the data, if I draw the data, lines up very well with this curve. So when I said yesterday that the morphology of dark matter, the morphology of structure, the morphology of these filaments and voids, this is a mathematical analysis, a mathematical statement on the fact that dark matter gives you the right morphology of structures and voids relative to what you see.
Yeah. So the number one, what is that, 8K versus 18?
This corresponds to the mode entering the horizon.
Okay.
So that's the inverse Hubble, and the K is the wave number, and I scale it by. Actually, I think that should be a...
A is the scale factor.
Scale factor, yeah, sorry.
The measurement of the power spectrum, how exactly does that work? Is that...
So the measurement of the power spectrum is, you take a telescope, you point it, and you look at galaxies. Mm-hmm. And you can make a big map. So, okay, there are different ways of projecting this, but if this is us and looking out, I see some distribution of galaxies here, and since some places all clumps, and other places all clumps, and other places all have kind of voids, and so on. So I'm looking at these galaxies, and the averaging procedure that I'm talking about here is I look at the two-point function. This is in real space between two adjacent points, and that's my average, and then I Fourier transform it, and I get that. So I do exactly the same analysis on matter densities or a very similar analysis on matter densities as I would for the CMB.
The two-point function, is that really a continuous locally quantity, or is that discrete?
Well, it's discrete here.
Yeah.
So here I'm writing it as a continuous quantity, but I can do a discrete approximation to it. So of course, I only have finitely many galaxies. But in the same way that the CMB fluctuations are discrete, in the sense that I look at two fluctuations at once, I compare two pixels. Mm-hmm. In the same way, I compare two galaxies here. So it's not exactly continuous, but I have enough galaxies that if I zoom out enough, it's basically continuous.
Yeah.
So but for example, the error bars on stuff out here on these very very large structures get to be large, for just because I only have so many large comparisons I can make. Whereas I get much smaller error bars on a small scale, because I have many, many smaller discrete elements that I can put into the averaging. Okay, so this is structure on very large scales, and we have something that seems to agree pretty well with, or agrees very well with lambda CDM. You can also look at structure on smaller scales, and for a lot of the particle physics dark matter signatures, you're actually pretty interested. Figure out what I should erase or not erase. You're actually pretty interested in the distribution of dark matter in galaxies, and especially our galaxy, because, well, it's the closest thing we have, and closer is easier to see. So just going back to here, at some point, for small fluctuations, the smaller fluctuations become unstable against collapsing. And the prediction for this curve is based on doing a linear expansion of the fluctuations and a linear expansion of the variations in the GR metric. It turns out that's only a good approximation if your delta quantity is much, much less than one. When the fluctuation becomes relatively large, relative to its size, the evolution becomes nonlinear because the fluctuation starts to self-gravitate. And this onset of self-gravitation corresponds to something called a Jeans instability that I just erased, but you'll cover this afternoon. But at some point, kind of over here, the evolution has become nonlinear. So what I mean by nonlinear is that you can't ignore the self-gravitational interaction of the stuff in the fluid. Now, this nonlinear stuff starts to compact, and it compacts into so-called dark matter halos. And these dark matter halos are what stars condense around to form galaxies. So what we would really like is to be able to see the halos directly. Unfortunately, we can't. At least not at the moment. But what we can do is try to map out the density distribution of dark matter in a halo around a galaxy by looking at galactic rotation curves. So there are two quantities that we're primarily interested in to describe the distribution of dark matter in a given galaxy. The first is the mass density. And the second is the velocity distribution. So the mass density, I think, is fairly obvious. The velocity distribution, the velocity distribution is something you've also seen in the context of, let's say, ideal gases. So an ideal gas follows a Maxwell velocity distribution. In the case of dark matter, we don't necessarily know what its velocity distribution is, but it's something that we're interested in because this distribution affects the signals of dark matter in detectors. And we'll get to that later on. Okay, so let me give you one simple example of a distribution. It's not entirely realistic, but it has some properties that will carry over to more general distributions that people actually use to make predictions. So So the example I want to give you is a so-called isothermal sphere. So there are two assumptions here. So you treat dark matter as an ideal gas. I'll say three assumptions. The second assumption is the temperature of this gas is the same everywhere, so a constant. So everywhere in the dark matter halo, in this so-called isothermal sphere, is going to have the same temperature. And finally, the sphere part, the distribution is spherical. Okay, so what I need for consistency, first of all, that this statement about an ideal gas, this means that the pressure is equal to PBT. So I'm using units where the Boltzmann constant is equal to unity, and H bar and C are equal to unity. So my ideal gas law just becomes pressure is equal to the number density times the temperature. This temperature we're fixing everywhere, and then we have a spherical distribution. And what we need for consistency in this picture is that we need to, if we look at a single volume element, the forces on that volume element should cancel off for hydrostatic equilibrium. So on the one hand, we're going to have a pressure from the gas. On the other hand, we're going to have a gravitational interaction on the gas from everything around it. So here's our sphere, or at least here's a part of the dark matter halo we're looking at. Again, we're assuming it's spherical. And suppose we look at a little bit, some distance r from the center of the sphere. If I just do, if I just balance forces on the volume element, the pressure on the outside of the volume element relative to the pressure on the inside is going to be given by the force of gravity on the volume element. Okay, and now let me mention that because the distribution is spherical, that means that our density function, our rho of r, or our rho of x, is only going to depend on the radius from the center. Okay, and then I need a dr here. So balancing forces, the pressure, so the statement is that the force of gravity pulling this into the middle of the sphere is going to be the difference in the pressures on the outside of the element versus the inside of the element. And because it's a spherical distribution, I only care about the amount of mass at a radius less than r. So I can do my usual thing and take dr to 0, and this just turns into a dp dr. Is equal to so this is the hydrostatic equation that I need to solve for the consistency of the isothermal sphere. And I have two different quantities here. I've got my pressure and I have my density. But because I'm assuming my dark matter is an ideal gas, and since I assume my temperature is constant, I can replace this P by that rho. And I can try to solve this. Now, this M less is just given by the integral from 0 to r, dr prime, rho of r prime. So this is actually an integral differential equation, in the sense that at the end of the day, I want to solve for rho of r. This P, this pressure is equivalent to d rho dr plus some other constants. But here I have a factor of rho, and here I have an integral of rho. So derivative of rho, integral of rho, rho. So first of all, it's an integral differential equation. And second of all, it's nonlinear. So it's a little bit of a mess. But what I can do is move all the r-dependent stuff, except for m less of r, over here, take a derivative. And what I come up with is ddr r squared over rho d rho dr is equal to minus g m over t 4 pi r squared rho. So solving this in general is a bit of a mess. But it's easy to find specific solutions by just making a guess. So just a usual ansatz trick. So I'm going to make a wild guess that rho of r is just given by some constant times r to the alpha. So just some power law in r. Now, if I take that and I plug it in, what I find is alpha is equal to minus 2. A is equal to t 2 pi gm. So this gives me my, so this gives me a consistent solution for the density, r to the minus 2. And this r to the minus 2 is kind of nice, because if you look at actual rotation curves of galaxies, they flatten out. And if you recall from last class, a flat rotation curve is consistent with a dark matter density distribution that falls off as 1 over r squared. So this is, in fact, what we get for our so-called isothermal sphere. So now, if I look at my, if I look at rho of r over r, okay, it's just a 1 over r squared. That's easy. But the other thing is, because this is an ideal gas with a given temperature, I also find that at every point, my velocity distribution is just a Maxwellian. In other words, f of v, all right, f of v is just goes as a Gaussian, with this V0 being okay, so this is this isothermal sphere assumption for a dark matter halo. Well, it's essentially, it's the simplest case you can think of. The cheat here, though, is, well, the assumption of sphericity is pretty reasonable. But the assumption of a constant temperature is a little bit iffy. But it does simplify the construction of everything. And under these assumptions, I get some reasonable shape for the dark matter halo. So, but I guess, as you see here, this is the simplest possible case I can think of. And even in this very simple case, I get some complicated nonlinear integral differential equation. So if I try to do this in more general cases, it's going to be a huge mess. So what people do in practice is do simulations. So So in practice, people do simulations. So these go by the name of n-body simulations. And what you do in this case, in principle it's simple, in practice it's very difficult, is you have essentially a box with some number of particles in it, and these particles in the box just evolve under mutual gravitational interaction. So you start with some reasonable initial condition, let all the particles go, and they zip around, do orbits, and collapse, and eventually they should settle down to something that looks like a dark matter halo with some velocity distribution and some density distribution. And there's a whole industry of people doing this. On the galactic scale, there's simulations called, there's one, some very well-known ones are Via Lactea and Aquarius, and there are more. And on galactic scales, these are big galactic scale ones. You can also do this one for large-scale structure on much larger scales. But the upshot of this is that on galactic scales, people come up with parameterizations of the complicated outputs of these numerical simulations. So just two comments. The first is that traditionally, these simulations have only involved dark matter. Only very recently have people put baryons in. So baryons are a lot harder to deal with than dark matter, because dark matter, in the case of dark matter, you just have essentially little billiard balls interacting only under gravity. So that's fairly easy. When you put baryons in, the baryons interact with themselves. They can clump and they can radiate off energy and do kinds of things that are much, much harder to simulate. So only very recently have baryons been put in. And I'll come back to this a little bit later today, but some of these simulations don't necessarily agree perfectly with observations. But it's thought that a large reason for that non-agreement is because baryons haven't been included yet in a really consistent way. But let me just mention quickly, there are popular fits to these distributions. And there are two popular classes. The first class is the so-called alpha, beta, gamma. So the alpha, beta, gamma, it's just some parameterized functions. So this is a fairly broad parameterization. The details in it don't matter so much. But I do want you to be familiar with the terminology. So some popular examples of specific fits to this are the so-called NFW profile. It stands for Navarro, Frank, and White. And this R dot is the radius of the sun, and this is about 8.5 kiloparsec. This is the distance of the sun from the center of our galaxy. And a second fit is a so-called iNASTO. Um, So the results of these more complicated simulations give you, these are examples of fits these more complicated situations that generalize this very simple isothermal sphere I wrote down. So for now, these particular forms don't matter so much, but it's going to turn out that the specific form of the dark matter profile we use is often going to be very important for the dark matter signals that we predict for experiments. And just a second comment about this. These simulations also make predictions for the velocity distribution. And typically, it looks like the velocity distributions that are predicted seem to be fit pretty well with Maxwellians, very similar to the isothermal sphere. But there's been a lot less work on looking at deviations from Maxwellians for these distributions than there has for specifically the density distributions. In
all these cases,
R is the distance from the center of the galaxy.
RS.
Oh, RS. RS is just a fit parameter.
Oh, okay. It's just some
variable that I float in the fit, and I fix it to fit the simulation.
And so we always use just a standard fitting program to get the parameter and. These different types, what exactly is the difference between those? We have different exponents. Is that the only difference?
That's the only difference. Yeah. So
why don't we fit that as well? I mean, we could also use software to try to get alpha, beta, gamma, which fits best with the data.
Yeah. Well, so there are two issues. The first is that the business of actually simulating this stuff is difficult. And the point is, because you can't do an infinitely large simulation, you have numerical noise.
Okay.
So what you tend to do is you repeat your simulation with different initial conditions a lot of times. And by looking at some combination of the results after they seem to converge, you get some profile, and you fit to that profile. But the point is that there's still some noise in that profile, and you might be able to do a better fit for a specific profile, but it's not necessarily, the physical content isn't necessarily greater. It's simply because you do have this noise in there. So these fits, these fits have two advantages. The first is that they're pretty simple. So for people who take these density distributions and use them to make other predictions, it's very handy to have a simple functional form. So what you could do in principle is do a more careful fit, and then use that in your predictions. It's just harder to use numerically. But it's also not clear whether the fancier fit would give you a more accurate result, given the fact that there are uncertainties in these distributions.
So what is the empirical input for this n-body simulation? So we have point particles which interact somehow, and then we...
Actually, this is a slightly controversial thing. There is very little empirical input. Essentially, you start with a box of particles, and you say the particles have a usual kinetic energy, whatever, and they just interact under two-body gravitational forces. So if I was to ask you to write down the equations of motion for a set of n particles in a box, this is just, you write down the equations of motion. That's exactly what they put in and simulate.
Okay, and a completely random distribution of velocity, or how?
They look at many different initial conditions. So
And afterwards, they put this popular fix over them and try to.
Yeah, so they take these simple parameterizations and they fit to their output.
And afterwards, is there any way to compare it with empirical data?
Yeah, well, I'm running out of time, but yes, there is. So the point is that these dark matter mass distributions affect rotation curves of galaxies. So you can do so. If you go off and you measure a lot of rotation curves of galaxies, you can measure, you can get an idea of what the dark matter distribution should be, and compare them to these simulations. So the experimental test of this of these numerical simulations are comparing the distributions that you predict from the rotation curves with these values, with these forms. So actually, at this point, this is actually a good point to mention that one of the challenges to this picture of dark matter is that these functional forms tend to have so-called cusps. In other words, if I look at the distribution of rho of r for small r, what I seem to find in simulations is some power law. R to the alpha, with alpha less than, let's say, minus 1.5, minus 1, minus 1.5, from a lot of simulations. Whereas if I actually look at galaxies, and I look at rotation curves of galaxies, the actual rotation curves, here's my nice green chalk, the actual rotation curves of galaxies seem to be flatter. So they seem to flatten up towards the interior instead of shooting up like this. So this has been used as a criticism of dark matter, and it's a valid criticism. Yeah.
So this is the dark matter density distribution.
Yeah. So this is the mass distribution.
Mass
which
distribution.
Is just,
and the green line is what we infer from galaxy rotation curves.
Yeah. So rotation curves give you this flat or thing, and then simulations give you something that's shooting up. So there's a technical terminology. The flat interior distribution is called a core. So the fact that the distribution flattens out in the middle, this flattening is said to be called a dark matter core. And then diverging distribution is called a cusp. So given this highly technical terminology, there's a so-called cusp quark problem. And the cusp quark problem is simply that the simulations seem to give you cusps, the observations seem to give you cores. And the general thinking and the resolution to this is that the answer to the cusp quark problem is ultimately going to be putting baryons into these simulations. So as far as these fits go, these fits are based on fits to pure dark matter simulations. So all of my n particles are essentially billiard balls that only interact under gravity. If I start putting baryons in, the simulation is much, much more difficult, because you have to keep track of them radiating and them interacting with each other in ways much more strongly than gravity. And at least some initial simulations involving baryons seem to find more of a core than a cusp. But it is still very much a work in progress and something we're trying to understand. OK, so I have maybe 5 minutes. So I wanted to say a few more quick things about dark matter and structure. And then after this, I'm going to get into essentially all particle physics. Okay, so far we've been assuming that dark matter is cold, so it's non-relativistic, and that dark matter also doesn't interact in any way except for gravity. So you might ask, what goes wrong if dark matter is not quite relativistic, or what happens if dark matter starts to interact with itself or with other stuff? So in the first case, you can look at not quite cold dark matter. So not quite cold means that you start to have some non-trivial velocity. And what happens when your particle starts to become relativistic is that when you have a gravitational potential well, if the particle has enough velocity, it can escape that well. So if you start off with a region that's overdense, if your dark matter is relativistic, that overdense region is likely to give you a net flux of stuff out of it into regions that are less dense. So warm or hot, dark matter, free streams. In the sense that it goes from regions of high density to regions of lower density. And this tends to wash out fluctuations in the local density. So the upshot of this is that if dark matter is either warm or hot, if I look at my matter power spectrum, this P of K over K, what I would see towards smaller scales is that instead of having just a power law fall off, I'd have a much sharper fall off. So for cold dark matter, I get this. For warm or hot dark matter, I would get this cutoff. And assuming that the dark matter is once thermalized, it turns out I can translate this into a limit on the dark matter mass that should be heavier than about 3 keV. Assuming it was thermalized at some point. If your dark matter is colder than this, if your dark matter is lighter than this, and it was once in contact with the thermal bath, then its residual velocity will be large enough that it'll start to wash out structure on small scales. So we really want relatively cold dark matter to avoid washing out small scale structure relative to observation. The second deviation is what happens if dark matter starts to interact. So we know that dark matter has to be dark, so it shouldn't interact very much with visible stuff. But one thing you can imagine is maybe the dark matter starts to interact with itself in some relatively strong way. It turns out that this also runs into problems. And there are, it runs into problems in lots of ways. But there are two primary ways that things get messed up. The first is that yesterday I told you about the bullet cluster. In the case of the bullet cluster, you see two clouds of dark matter passing through each other. And if dark matter interacts a lot with itself, these clouds wouldn't have passed through each other in that way. So from this, you can put a limit on the self-interacting cross-section relative to the dark matter mass, should be less than about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared for GeV. It turns out that the bullet cluster is not actually the strongest limit on this kind of interaction. You can actually get a slightly stronger limit from the fact that looking at certain sets of galaxy clusters, certain sets of galaxy clusters seem to show that their dark matter halo is elliptical. So in other words, I've got some galaxies, and I have a dark matter halo around this dark matter around this galaxy cluster, and this dark matter halo, instead of being spherical, is relatively elliptical. Now it turns out that if the dark matter starts interacting with itself, this elliptical halo would have relaxed to a spherical halo. So the fact that you see elliptical halos for certain galaxy clusters puts limits on how much dark matter can self interact. So the limits from elliptical halos give you actually a slightly stronger bound. Of about the cross section is less than minus 10 to the minus 25 centimeters squared for GeV. Now, just for comparison, you can look at the size of the self interaction you would expect if dark matter interacted only under the weak force. Yep.
So, wouldn't one expect the shape of the halo to be dependent on the shape of the galaxy cluster?
Well, it goes the other way around. They remember, the dark matter collapses first.
Okay.
It acts as a potential well for the baryons, and the baryons fall in and then form galaxies.
Right.
So the idea is that the visible stuff is tracking the density of dark matter. But in fact, the elliptical halos, you actually do a better job. You can actually map out the halo through gravitational lensing. So you get good evidence that it's elliptical. Okay, but just for reference, if I have a dark matter particle that scatters with itself through the weak force, what I would expect is that this cross section should go something like the weak coupling constant to the fourth power divided by some number of 4 pi times 1 over the weak scale. And then I actually need to divide by the mass, as 1 over the dark matter mass. And if I put in numbers, what I find is something that looks like GV over M, 10 to the minus 35 centimeters squared for GV. So the point is that the weak force is actually weak enough to be consistent with these limits on the dark matter self-interaction. So this is going to be interesting in the next few classes when I'm going to talk about WIMPs, so-called weakly interacting massive particles as dark matter. But the point is that the weak force is weak enough to be consistent with the observed dark matter picture. Okay, so I guess I'll wrap it up there. From now on, I'm going to turn more to particle physics. So a look at the particle physics interactions that produce a density of dark matter particles in the universe, as well as ways to look for dark matter through direct detection, indirect detection experiments, and colliders. But I also have some flexibility in what I cover. So I guess I'm also curious to hear what people would like to hear about. So are there any aspects of dark matter that you've heard about that you're maybe more interested in than others, or is there anything you'd like me to focus on? No strong feelings.
Sounds good.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm probably more interested in particle physics aspect and also nice mathematical structure, whatever arises.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other requests or? No? All right.
I thought the current schedule looked really good.
Okay.
It was exactly what I was interested in.
Okay. Anyway, I'm trying to go over. Well, I'm going to try to cover the stuff you need to get started doing research on dark matter stuff. So there's kind of a standard things set of things I should cover. That I'm going to try to get on. But actually, dark matter is pretty good because unlike some other things, you can get going doing like really cutting edge research pretty quickly. So my aim is to try to give you the background to get into that field, sort of almost immediately. So, okay, I see it.